time, live from Studio A. This is Global Media News on OWWR, Old Westbury Web Radio. I'm Stephen Shaw.
And I'm Kelly Hinn. This week we have news from Sri Lanka, India, China, Europe, the United Kingdom, Haiti, Saudi Arabia, and Uganda.
From Sri Lanka?
Did Facebook fuel deadly anti-Muslim riots in March?
From India?
How does Bollywood use social media to promote content?
From China?
Will the government throttle the esports revolution in China?
From the European Union?
Have British tabloids gone too far? Should there be limits?
From the UK?
Cyberbullying is in the news.
From Haiti?
How did social media react after the quake?
From the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia?
Social in Saudi, and what happened to Jamal Khashoggi?
From Uganda?
Social censorship in Uganda. Can you say what you want?
All this and more coming up on OWWR, Old Westbury Web Radio, streaming live from the State University of New York, College of Old Westbury.
Let's head to South Asia to hear about the beautiful island of Sri Lanka, just south of India. Sri Lanka was a British colony until 1948. It was known as Ceylon until 1972, when the nation changed its name to Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka's recent history was scarred by a brutal ethnic civil war that lasted for 25 years, ending in 2009. There are still ethnic and religious tensions that sometimes erupt violence. This spring, tensions flared into violent anti-Muslim rights. Rutheria Pierre is on this story. Rutheria, when the news of this anti-Muslim riots broke out in March of 2018, many pointed to Facebook as playing a key role in the spreading of the violence. What part did social media play in inciting the violence with viral hate speech, and what can be done about it?
The issue with Sri Lanka has been going on for a while. Things got into a fury in the beginning of March, earlier this year, when hate speech and fake news took over social networks such as Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and WhatsApp. But the government in Sri Lanka feels that Facebook is not censoring stuff enough, and people are too freely making up certain things. And what it is between the Buddhist and the Muslim community in Sri Lanka, it's causing riots, it's causing people to be against each other. And what happened was the government put like a ban on it. So people were upset, of course, because you can't just have something to the public and then just take it right away. And they feel like social media is a way to keep people updated on what's going on. They feel like it's a way to communicate, give their opinion. So a lot of people felt like they went overboard, but the government felt like as if they kept it, you know, running.
That's what they needed to do.
Exactly. It was the most necessary thing to do. And they also didn't just ban Facebook. They banned Instagram and WhatsApp as well, which made people even more upset because it's like if you're going to ban...
Now you're completely cutting us off.
Cutting us all off, you know what I'm saying? So I think that was just a big turnoff. And in my opinion, Facebook and these social sites do need to go a little bit harder when it comes to censoring certain things and not letting things touch the media, because stuff like this happens and it just turns everybody off and everybody gets into a fury, especially a country like Sri Lanka, only because they have a lot of religious issues going on and a lot of people are against each other. So the fake news only causes things to get worse. Another major thing is that people, like I said, feel like you can't just give something and take it away. And I feel like, in my opinion, I understand that, because it's like, if that was happening here, we would all be livid because of how invested we are in social media. But at the same time, it's about what's best for the country. So I think that was just a very important step.
Agreed.
For Global Media News, I am Rutheria Pierre. Back to you, Kelly.
Thanks, Rutheria. Let's head north across the Palm Strait from the island nation of Sri Lanka to the subcontinent of India for some social media news from Bollywood, the movie capital of India, centered in the great city of Mumbai. Bollywood, just like Hollywood, is in the star-making business. Social media is playing an increasingly important role in promoting Bollywood celebrities and the many, many films produced in Mumbai each year. According to the Economic Times, somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 films are produced every year, generating more than $2 billion in revenue. How has social media changed the way people market themselves?
People use social media to connect with their fan base at the click of a button. Whether it's on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, celebrities are constantly engaging with their followers. Many celebrities use social media to promote their projects.
Which Bollywood celebrities use social media platforms to promote films and how?
Sonu Kapoor and Amir Khan have used social media to promote their films. Sonu Kapoor has a following of 13.9 million followers on Instagram and used this platform to promote her film. She had posted a video of the signature steps from the main dance and song from the movie. She had then requested her fan base to create their own dance videos and tag her in them so she can repost. This is a great way of connecting with others, considering the singing and dancing is a huge part of Bollywood as well as Indian culture. The post actually became viral, and not only Indian fans are watching it, but American fans from just all over the world. So I think that it's important to show their culture to the rest of the world as well. Amir Khan had promoted the film he was starring in Three Idiots, which came out in 2015, and he used a unique and different tactic. He was disguising himself around the streets of India and posting his whereabouts on Facebook. And he was using the hashtag, Where's Amir? And I think hashtags actually are very helpful when you're following a certain cause or if you're following a certain celebrity. And he has a fan base of over 15 million people on Facebook, and he wanted his supporters to come and find him. Once he was found, he was, while being incognito, he would give free tickets to the premiere of the film. He was dressing as a commoner, which people found amusing and relatable. He was in rickshaws. He was dressing up and singing with just random people on the street, which I thought this people found like very intriguing because it's very different to see a celebrity in that light.
Do you believe that Indian celebrities use social media differently than American celebrities?
Mm-hmm. I do think that many techniques that American and Indian celebrities have are the same. Like they take pictures with other celebrities or they post content off of like what's going on in their life. But celebrities in particular, like Sonam Kapoor and Amir Khan, have used Indian culture with their promoting, which puts Indian culture on display into the world. I think this makes others more aware of all that Bollywood has to offer. Sonam Kapoor showed the element of Indian dancing, while Amir showed the aspect of traditional Indian clothing. For Global Media News, I'm Jennifer Sadana. Back to you, Kelly.
Thanks, Jennifer. Let's keep heading north in Asia, up from India to China. We'll be right back with an update on esports news from China. Can the government regulate gaming and control millions of esports fans by making China be esports power?
Cody Zaffron is on the esports beat in China. Cody, last week you told us about the growing popularity of esports in China. For the Chinese tech giants behind the gaming and esports industry in China are very big business. The government wants prosperity and success of these tech giants like Tencent and Alibaba to boost the Chinese economy. How are esports doing in China?
Esports are continuing to grow. Alienware is a big company, and they just opened a state-of-the-art esports stadium in eastern China.
How is the Chinese government handling competitive gaming?
The Chinese government is cracking down on competitive gaming. They banned Twitch. Twitch was part of Amazon and focuses on live stream gaming, including esports competitions. They blocked Twitch once. It became popular because China didn't cover esports at the Asian Games on regular broadcast channels, and the apps have since been removed from China's Apple Store. Besides Twitch, there's also a company called Tencent, which is a Chinese global investment company. They've been around for 20 years. Tencent is reported to be the world's largest gaming and social media companies. In addition, Tencent is reported to be the world's most valuable technology company, which services products in mobile and multiplayer online games. Tencent had to restructure the company for the first time in 6 years due to China's government's regulations. The regulations on video games in China have cost the company over $20 billion. On top of the regulations, the Chinese government has not issued permission for publishers to release new games since March.
Is China's reaction having any effect on the economy?
Yes, it is. Tencent, it's the largest gaming company in the world. Their company has taken a major hit, losing $20 billion. I just think it's a power struggle between the Chinese government wanting to, because it's such a big influence on their market, it's a power struggle between them wanting to see it prosper and then also wanting to put a thumb on it to kind of control the citizens of China. For Global Media News, I'm Cody Zaffron. Back to you, Steve.
Thanks, Cody. Up next, we jump to Europe with Eli Pedway. Should there be limits on press freedom? Can the press, especially the tabloid press, go too far? British tabloids are famous for sensational content and scandal mongering. Nothing sells papers like a quatrain celebrity sex scandal. Not everyone in Europe agrees that the British press should be able to print anything it wants. Eli Petway has a story about one European politician who was very angry about being dragged through the mud by British tabloids. Eli, tell us about him. Who is Jean-Claude Juncker, and what was the tabloid coverage that made him angry enough to call for limits on British press freedom this summer?
Just to give a brief background of who he is, Jean-Claude Juncker is actually the president of the European Commission. He's been the president since November 1st, 2014. He actually has a long career of politics in Europe. He was the prime minister of Luxembourg from 1995 to 2013. The president role of the European Commission is that he's able to decide on the organization of the commission. He can make portfolios to members of the commission and is able to make changes at any time he wants. The president can also determine the commission's policy agenda, defends the general European interest. So just to break down to what the European Commission is, it's a team of 28 commissioners, one from each EU country, and they are very important. They are responsible for drawing up proposals for new European legislation and those implements, the decisions of the European Parliament and the Council for the EU as well. They represent and speak on behalf of all EU countries and the international bodies of them, usually in areas of trade policy and humanitarian aid, focus on strategic planning and collective decision-making as well. To answer your question also about what did Chief Juncker say about the press freedoms, he said that they should be limited on press freedoms. The reason this started because earlier this year, he was accused of actually being intoxicated at a NATO summit in Brussels. After a video came out with him apparently unable to walk without assistance and being taken away in a wheelchair, his spokesperson said had to actually come out and say that he was suffering from a painful attack. It was accompanied by cramps as well, and that he just lost respect after concerns of his health was questioned. He suggested that the media's coverage of him violated his rights, and he was very unapologetic about it. And he said they do not respect the human rights of political leaders at all, and that he will not miss it. Press freedom also has its limits. One should not bring people in privacy and distress.
Has there been any other political leaders upset with the media?
Well, one lady named Françoise Chapems, who is the mayor of Molenbeek, is actually seeking to file a civil lawsuit against Katie Hopkins, and she's a famous British journalist, for her depicting the Brussels neighborhood as the European capital of jihadism. Chapems claimed she wasn't even aware she was speaking to a journalist at first, and that the interaction was being filmed, and she was correct, because Katie Hopkins actually posted a video of her on Twitter later during the day. She said that it happens to her often. People come up to her on the street and ask her questions about the neighborhood, but usually it's positive things only. And she mentioned how that Hopkins is doing this to attack the residents of Molenbeek, and that cannot be allowed to contribute to happen. What the journalist did was inexcusable. In her comments, she's shown a real desire to break Molenbeek.
What's your final thoughts on the situation?
So what makes these cases a little uncomfortable is that there will have to be a discussion sooner or later about the limits when it comes to privacy of politicians or just privacy of anybody when it comes to them being in the media. Mr. Juncker and Ms. Chapems are both examples of how people who work with the government are fed up with the media and are feeling like they're taking things too far when it comes to their privacy. It makes you wonder if they will end up limiting press freedoms and rights in the long run, not only in Europe, but can it catch around the globe as well.
My co-host, Stephen Shaw, is on the UK Media Beat. This week, Stephen has a story about a campaign to make people aware of the effects of cyberbullying. Stephen, our first lady, Melania Trump, is also leading a campaign against cyberbullying. It seems like cyberbullies are big news on both sides of the Atlantic.
The Stop Speak Support Cyberbullying Day is an event to spread awareness to young people and children who may have experienced cyberbullying. The day will bring cyberbullying into the form of a discussion and will help make people aware of this ongoing issue.
How bad is the problem of cyberbullying among children and young people in the UK?
The cyberbullying problem in the UK is not good. According to the Anti-Bullying Alliance, 24% of the young people and children will experience cyberbullying of some degree. 17% of young people and children will bully others. Many people are worried about what children see and do online.
What social media guidelines will be discussed on Cyberbullying Day?
The guidelines of Cyberbullying Day are to stop and speak up about cyberbullying incidents. Let a victim of cyberbullying know that they aren't alone. This can make a big difference to a victim who has experienced cyberbullying.
What is your personal opinion about cyberbullying?
I think that cyberbullying is harmful to people and it needs to be stopped. This Cyberbullying Day is to promote awareness, and it's important because it's bringing the topic of cyberbullying into the form of a discussion, and it's trying to help others.
Do you feel like the cyberbullying campaign, like the one in the UK, would be beneficial in the United States?
I think a cyberbullying campaign like the one in the UK would be helpful in the US. I hope the anti-bullying campaign grows internationally and puts a stop to a disrespectful behavior affecting our society. For Global Media News, I'm Stephen Shaw. Back to you, Kelly.
Thanks, Stephen. A very big earthquake devastated Haiti in 2010. This month, more tremors shook in Haiti on October 6th. The shock from this smaller 5.9 magnitude earthquake was felt all over Haiti. About 15 people died and hundreds more were injured. After the enormous earthquake in 2010, there was a lot of discussion of the role of social media in spreading information about the quake and the role of social media in earthquake relief efforts. Christina Pierre-Louis has been looking at the part that social media plays in these natural disasters in Haiti in 2010 and 2018. Christina, what can you tell us about social media use in Haiti and its role in the aftermath of these quakes?
On January 12th of 2010, Haiti was hit with an earthquake with a magnitude of 7.0. This earthquake left about 200,000 people dead and the island in shambles. Most of the people affected by this earthquake lived in Port-au-Prince, which is the center of Haiti. The use of Twitter brought mass awareness to the tragedy and helped raise millions of dollars in effort to provide relief. Two of the top trending efforts for the relief were organized by the American Red Cross and Wyclef Jean. The American Red Cross is a relief organization, and Wyclef Jean is a popular musician, former band member of Black Eyed Peas. Because of their platform, both of their tweets were able to go viral. So many people were attempting to help the cause that the system for the donation started to have problems. Facebook made a filter to bring as their support for the tragedy, and their filter was basically the Haitian flag over your profile. They made a page that allowed people to communicate, and with that, people were able to communicate at high speed arrays with mass communication. A few years after the devastation, rumors began that the American Red Cross is not using all the money that they received to aid in the cause of Haiti, and that Wyclef was doing concerts where all the money that was supposed to go to the relief did not. They're just rumors, though. But they received a lot of backlash, even to this day, because of the awareness that social media has brought to the tragedy. Every year on January 10th, you'll see a lot of people posting about the earthquake that happened in 2010 and praying for all people that lost their family members and their homes. Some of them still have no homes to return to. Some of the buildings are still, a lot of the buildings are still destroyed. This year, on October 6th, another earthquake with a magnitude of 5.9 hit Haiti. This one occurred in Port-au-Prince. About 15 people died and hundreds were left injured. I've seen Haitians post about it, but it has not gotten the same amount of awareness that the 2010 earthquake received. That's because the devastation was not as big. They were still trying to recover from the last earthquake. Some people might also find it as like almost no point to kind of give.
Would you say that social media from 2010 to 2018 has helped the efforts there, or do you think that it's like stayed stagnant.
I think it has helped. Well, it's attempted to help the efforts there. Haiti is one of those countries that don't really get a lot of attention, you know, kind of left to this back burner. But Twitter made more such attention to it. I don't think without Twitter that it would have gotten as much donations as it received. For Global Media News, I'm Christina Pierre-Leaf. Back to you, Kelly.
Thanks, Christina. Up next, social in Saudi and the death of Saudi Arabian journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Stay with us.
Kelly Hentz is on the social media in Saudi Arabia beat this week. The big news out of Saudi Arabia is the killing of Saudi Arabian journalist named Jamal Khashoggi, who worked as a columnist for the Washington Post. Kelly, start off with a discussion of social media in Saudi Arabia before we turn to the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi Arabian consulate in Turkey. Kelly, is social media censored in Saudi Arabia?
I think the question to ask lately is what's not censored in Saudi Arabia. It is known as to be one of the tightest media-controlled regions in the area, and they're proud of it. They don't deny it to their people. They're happy to tell them that they're picking and choosing what they're putting forth into their communities. Mainly, they're using this to like filter out pornographic images, Islam-related articles, human rights, and political sites that would cause, you know, maybe a revolution or an uproar between their population and the government, which is beginning to happen as we speak. Most countries with things like censorships will have a few brave individuals that will go into the spotlight to be an advocate for something that they strongly believe in. Social media has been such a great tool to help tie all of those things together. The platforms are a great channel to spread word in the public of corruption that's going on inside the walls of their country. Manal Sharif, Al-Sharif, is a role model and influencer from Saudi Arabia, whose strides have reached out and made so many people more aware. I think her overall goal throughout her career as an activist has been to make the people strong and make them aware, providing a platform where people can go to her or go to her Twitter to reach out, to ask questions, is so important. Saudi Arabia is home to 40% of Twitter users in the Arabian region. It's interesting to see that all of these people are giving her their feedback through a platform that most people in the country don't even have access to right now. Being a censored state makes it quite a challenge, but Sharif's powerful campaigns, she's been successful. Through the use of Twitter, she's rapidly promoted the two causes, hashtag Women to Drive and Women to Hack Academy. As Jennifer said earlier in our webcast, the hashtag behind in front of a cause makes it more exciting for people to participate. It gives them a purpose, and it makes it easy for them to say what they want to put out to the world, whether on social media, like, you know, you hear people saying the word hashtag before things, like it starts a movement. In 2011, she was actually imprisoned for driving a vehicle in Saudi Arabia. So in 2011 was when she started her campaign for women to drive. June 24th, 2018, Saudi Arabia recently lifted the ban, but unfortunately she was not able to attend because she is banned from the country of Saudi Arabia because of her government critiques and her exploitations throughout social media, especially Twitter, have caused such an uproar. Of course, her journey cannot be compared to Jamal Khashoggi's after what we know he went through about 2 weeks ago. They can be compared, I believe, because they're both fighting for similar causes. They're both fighting for their people, and they're both fighting for an overall better community in their country. Both of them being in the spotlight, obviously, you face a lot of threats, you have a lot of fears, but they don't care. They want their country to know and be informed and be able to make their own decisions if they want to leave, if they want to start a revolution, if there are so many different things that if they want to be active on Twitter, like there's tools and resources that they're able to provide to them if they choose to do so. It's super important to have these kind of advocates because a lot harder to sentence people to prison when it's in thousands and millions of quantity, but when it's one person, they'll put one person away for everybody else's actions. And I think that takes like a lot of bravery, and I think that's something that the two of them shared together. For Global Media News, I'm Kelly Hinds. Back to you, Stephen.
Thanks, Kelly. Let's keep talking about social media. Brianna Smith has been looking at social media and free speech in Uganda. Uganda is independent, but it was a British colony until 1962. Uganda was ruled by a brutal dictator, Idi Amin, from 1971 to 1979. The current president, Yoweri Museveni, has been in power since 1986. Brianna, tell us a bit about media and social media in Uganda. Is there freedom of the press and the media in Uganda?
According to Freedom House, the Press and Journalists Act requires journalists to register with their government, establish the National Institute of Journalists of Uganda. They do have some freedom, but then it's restrictions like this. Also, they have to make sure they have a degree in the university to be full members of the National Institute of Journalists of Uganda. So it's like, they can, you know, do the whole journalist thing, but then again, they must have these requirements.
What happened to the journalist James Akina?
Oh, James Akina, so he was pretty much trying to get some photography on this music artist named Bobby Wine. But the artist, he was getting attacked by the People's Defense Force soldiers in Uganda. So because he was taking those type of photographs, he got attacked as well.
Why is the government of Uganda aiming to shut down different houses of media?
That it's harder to control the social structure when it comes to social media.
Do you feel social media should be controlled?
Honestly, I don't think it should be controlled at all because it's part of this millennium. Like, we use social media for income. A lot of people, different type of people with crafts, like, you know, if it's music, art, whatever you do, social media is a way to display that. Like I said, a way to get income, a way to get your message out to different people all over the world. It's just an instant, quick way to communicate with people as well. So I don't think it should be controlled at all just because the government or whatever, they don't agree with certain things.
Thank you, Brianna. That's all for this week. Our fearless producer is Christian Brave. Thanks to Kelly Hinds for hosting with me this week. Many thanks to our engineering team, Miguel Castro and Brendan Johnson.
Today we heard reports from Kelly Hinds, Eli Petway, Rutheria Pierre, Christina Pierre-Louis, Stephen Shaw, Jennifer Sineda, Brianna Smith, and Cody Zafran.
Global Media News is brought to you by OWWR, Old Westbury Web Radio, and the Media and Communications Department here at State University of New York College at Old Westbury.
For more media news and resources, check out our latest post at globalmedianews.org, where you can listen to all of our webcasts and even subscribe to our podcast feed.
Follow us on Twitter at OWWRGMN. Use our Twitter feed to keep up with the latest news for aspiring journalists and media professionals. That's at OWWRGMN.